Much for coming to this session. My name's Oren Thomas, and this is going to be Rolling Core Infrastructure Upgrades. So there's going to be a bit of conceptual stuff at the start, and then we're going to move on to some of the detail a little later on. But one of the important things to realize, and one of the reasons for this session, is it comes down to how Microsoft is conceiving the future of operating systems and how that has a follow-on effect to how you manage infrastructure running on Microsoft operating systems. And we know that Microsoft is changing the way that they are going to release operating systems in future. If you haven't heard about it, Microsoft is changing things. And some of you haven't, and this is the interesting thing. There's some of us that are sort of plugged into Twitter, plugged into social media, and we sit there and we consume all of the information that comes out of the mothership, and we think, oh, wow, they're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this. Then there's the rest of us who are a bit more human, who actually turn off when we come home from work, and we think, I don't want to hear about Microsoft until I get back to work tomorrow. So a lot of that news kind of gets ignored. Is it relevant to me right now? Great. If it's not, I'll get to it when I can. So we've heard Windows 10 being called the last version of Windows. Is Windows Server 2016 the last version of Windows Server? So when we're talking about the last version of Windows 10, we're talking about Windows 10 as a service. And what the last version of Windows 10 means? Well, the statements on this and how people have interpreted this have not led us to have a great deal of clarity on what we're actually talking about. What it means is that Windows Server and Windows Client are going to be incrementally improved. That is, that there's a substantial number of features in Windows 10 that were announced at the original Ignite in the US that were talked about yesterday in the keynote that are not actually included in the product as it exists right now. Enterprise data protection is a really good example of that. You may have heard about enterprise data protection, that feature where you can tag particular data as belonging to the organization, which means that you can't take it out of a Word document and then paste it into a WordPress blog post. The operating system will stop you doing that. The operating system will stop you doing that when that feature is lit up. But that feature is not actually going to be available until several months from now. So what I'm talking about here, when we're talking about as a service, what we're going to do is we're going to get an understanding that the features that exist in the operating system at release are not going to be representative of the features that exist in the operating system a year down the track. We've gone from this monolithic, this is what Windows Server 2012 R2 looks like now, and we know that when end of support expires in 2023, that's what Windows Server 2012 R2 is going to look like. This is not going to apply to future versions of the operating system. These features become available as updates over the coming months. So, as I said, Windows 10 functionality in September 2016 is going to be different to Windows Server functionality in September 2016. That a year from now, Windows 10 is actually going to do a whole lot more that it doesn't do right now. And that Microsoft's not saying, well, we're going to release that in the next version of the operating system. What is going to happen, and this is going to apply to server and to client, is that features are going to be released when they're ready to be released. So in the past, you might have had the DNS team who had a feature ready at a certain point in time. And that might have been 2 years before the next major release of the operating system. So they kind of sat on it for 2 years. Now, as those features become available, they can be pushed out into the product. So as these incremental improvements occur, the media in stores for Windows 10, downloadable from MSDN or from the volume licensing site, will actually be incremented. In 2017, for example, you won't buy a laptop with Windows 10 and then spend ages installing updates. What will happen is the OEMs will be presented or given constantly updated media, or they'll maintain their own updated media, and then hopefully you'll only have 1 or 2 months of updates, only as long as that laptop's sort of been in the box and on the shelf. Now, it's not that Windows 10 or Windows Server 2016 is going to be the last version of Windows. It's more that version matters don't matter as much anymore. We see this a lot with Linux distributions, where with Linux distributions, if you keep yourself mostly up to date, you don't really have to bump yourself when you go from one version to another, because often you've already upgraded your kernel, you've already updated your packages, and all of the bits and pieces that are on there are actually running at a particular version anyway. And sort of a new version is a milestone saying, right, this is where the operating system exists at this point in time. And we saw that with the release of Windows 10, where there was a particular build number at release. And then if you're in the Insiders program, you're actually about 3 or 4 build numbers beyond what Windows 10 was at release. And there's still already different things in the operating system. We saw this morning, it was announced that Cortana's lit up in Australia and New Zealand. So if you're running Windows 10, there'll be an update there for you if you're in the Insiders ring, and then suddenly Cortana is going to be on. If you're running not in the inside ring, you won't have that functionality yet, but that's a substantial change for most people in the functionality of the product. So let's think of it another way. Who here knows what version of Chrome or Firefox they have installed? Some of you, but most of you don't care. Why? Because the version numbers sort of become irrelevant. Now, there will be updated version numbers, but it's going to be like Chrome or Firefox, so those build numbers. The only way you're going to understand it is if you type a ver in a command prompt and see what version of the operating system you've got. Or like Mac OS X, where the version numbers are important to some people, but not something most people think about. You've got the big point and then all the little points, and you don't really worry about the little points too much. So although nothing, and I've got to clear this, there's nothing that's been announced about Windows Server, it's not surprising, or it will not be a surprise, that this approach is going to be taken with the server operating system. Now, we're going to certainly find out more about what's going on close to the release of Windows Server, and at the moment, that's sometime early next year. However, this does not restrict me and does not restrict us from wildly and unfoundedly speculating about what's going on. And as bad as the idea of being entirely speculative sounds, in the medium-term future, we've all got to speculate about what things are going to look like in the next year, the next 5 years, so that we've got some sort of plan going on in our head as to how we are going to deal with that. As people who manage infrastructure, as people who are responsible for managing these servers, if we have no idea whatsoever is going to happen next year or 2 years from now, then we're at a significant disadvantage. So Microsoft and pretty much everybody does have a 5-year roadmap to 2020. Microsoft doesn't share their entire roadmap to 2020 because, as Yoda would say, always in motion is the future. And that roadmap may need to be quickly revised. Things change. What Microsoft thought 2015 would look like is very different from what 2015 looked like. You saw that with, for example, Windows 8 and the wonderful idea to remove the start button and the start menu, okay? So there was a change. What they thought the future was going to look like was it was all going to be tablety and people would take to that new interface, and they didn't, so they had to change direction. And one of the things about the new Microsoft is that they always want to be as nimble as a startup, which means that if they need to change direction, they can do so fast. If there's something that becomes important, they need to be able to go there. Things are always changing. It's better to have a plan and then to revise that plan than to have no idea what's going on at all. And that's the main thing I'm talking about when we're talking about speculation. I'm saying have a plan. And then you can change it when you understand that conditions have changed. But at least you've got a plan. If you don't sit there and plan, if you don't sort of have an idea of where you want to go, you're just going to be sitting there and be surprised by the future. And you see that in all aspects of life. If you're planning to do something, you can go out and do it. But if you don't get those plans in process, it's like a mate of mine who is 42 and he's still living with his mum. Wonderful guy. But I remember talking to him when he was 28 and I said, where do you see yourself by 40? And he said, I'll be married with children. And he wasn't. Why? Because he never had a plan to not be living with his mum. He was always content each day to wake up and still be living with his mum. And his mum's a wonderful person and he's a wonderful guy. But I say to my 12-year-old, gee, you want to end up like that guy? And he says, I don't want to be living with you past 18. And I said, that's two of us. Now, Microsoft will only share stuff that will definitely happen. And I've learnt that reason because anybody here can tell you about WinFS. Before Vista came out, there was publicity about this new relational file system. And if you ever watch a Microsoft announcement on some open source bulletin boards or websites like Slashdot, and they talk about a new feature in Windows, they go, oh yeah, but they never released WinFS, so we don't know that that's coming out. So Microsoft's really relentless. Unless they're going to get it out the door, don't talk about it. For 2020 vision, have plans what your server infrastructure will look like 5 years from now. And then just simply revise those plans as necessary. This is much better than taking a reactive approach, which is simply, wow, something's come out and I've got no idea how to deal with it. Who here knows about IP address management? Right, now IP address management is an awesome feature that came out in Server 2012 and was in Server 2012 R2. It basically allows you to centrally manage all of your DHCP servers. But people don't know about this, and there's still people out there who are managing each DHCP server individually. So keep your eyes up, look, sort of have a look around, find out what's going on, and coming to an event like this is a great sort of indicator that you are at least interested in hearing about what's going on, and then have plans. Find a feature like IPAM and go, well, IPAM's not where it is, where I want it to be at the moment, but at some stage in the next year or two, I actually want to centrally manage all of our DHCP servers because we've got 15 of them and it's a pain in the backside to actually go and manage each one individually. And that's what I'm talking about. Know where you want to go and figure out how to get there. And we see that with Server 2003. When Server 2003, and I've got a slide on this a little later, comes out, at end of support, there were 10 million Server 2003 servers still reporting to Windows Update. Now, I was at another conference in Redmond a couple of weeks ago, and I asked this question, I'll ask you, who here, and don't feel bad about it, still has 2003 in their environment? Right. Now, that is not surprising, and don't feel embarrassed about it, because as you can see, lots of other people are there. Now, who here has 2003 in their environment because they really love 2003? No one. Who here has 2003 in their environment because circumstances have just meant that they haven't been able to get rid of it yet? Exactly. And this is what I'm talking about, planning. Now, even with the best planning, you're sometimes going to run into a manager or circumstances where you can't get around that. But there would have been no one when they put those servers in who sat there and thought to themselves, yeah, I want to be running that in 2015. So let's talk about the future of Windows Server. We've already heard that with Nano Server, features will be continually added after release. Now, Nano Server is one of those interesting ones that not everybody's heard of. Who here knows what Nano Server is precisely? No one. That's good for Jeffrey Snover. Nano Server is an installation option of Windows Server 2016. It is a headless minimum footprint OS. And by headless, I mean more headless than Server Core. Nano Server, you can't log on to it directly. So what you do is you can set an admin password and you can view the IP address assigned to the server, or you can set one by yourself. So there's a little control panel that you can do that much. Everything else you do from PowerShell or remotely. And the idea is with Server Core, you absolutely reduced the attack footprint of the operating system by removing absolutely every component that didn't need to be there. Nano Server is even further scaled down. Nano Server will run in 400 meg of RAM and will run with a footprint of about 500 meg of data. So the idea is that suddenly you are going to be able to have infrastructure servers, and it's eventually, it won't be at release, that are running in these absolute minimum footprint servers. So instead of just pulling a domain controller with a GUI, assigning a couple of gig of RAM to it in your hypervisor, assigning 20 gig of hard disk space to it, you're suddenly going to be able to have a domain controller that's sitting there using half a gig of RAM, maybe a gig of disk space, or depending on the size of your Active Directory database. So this is where Microsoft is talking about going. You manage it remotely rather than locally. And this is going to freak people out, because the first time, bless you, that people use it, they go, how do I log on? How do I set things up? No, you don't. You might set the, and initially, until Technical Preview 3 of Windows Server, you couldn't even do that. You actually had to have an ANSI file built into the virtual hard disk that would go and set your local administrator password and how the IP address was going to be picked up. And then the first communication you had with the server was establishing a remote PowerShell session. It lacks a GUI, does not allow remote logon, has drastically reduced requirements. It will ship for Windows Server 2016, supporting a small number of roles, including Hyper-V, scale-out file servers, Core CLR, and ASP.NET 5. It has been intimated that within a year, it will function as a domain controller, a DNS server, and a DHCP server. So this is what I'm talking about, evolution of the OS. What's released and what it'll do a year from now are two different things. And the argument that they're making about NanoServer right now is that if you had a computer even running the server core version of Windows last year, you had to reboot it something like 28 times to apply software updates over the year. With NanoServer, it's so cut down, you would have had to have rebooted it 4 times. And they want to use NanoServer on those gigantic racks that they use in Azure data centers, because in Azure data centers, if there's something like, someone said 37 million servers or something like that in Azure, 37 million times 28 reboots versus 37 million times 4 reboots is a substantial cost saving. So Microsoft, when you hear it's born in the cloud and it comes down to us, what they mean is we need it because we're running at such scale that you'll get a benefit out of this. So, over time, as I said, the number of roles that can be deployed on NanoServer will increase. And it has been stated publicly that any role that currently runs on Windows Server 2012 will, at some stage in the future, run on NanoServer. And that will, at some point, change how you think of deploying. Now, Server 2016 still comes with a GUI. It still comes with a server core option. But there's this third option that's sneaking in. And it's NanoServer. And NanoServer is the one you've got to watch, because when you're thinking about upgrading your core infrastructure services, when you're thinking you've got a branch office deployment, and you've got your branch office and you go and throw a DC out there, you go throw a file server out there, you go throw a DNS server out there and a DHCP server, what do you want to throw out there? Do you want to throw out server with a GUI as a VM? Or do you want to throw out these really small, bite-sized virtual machines that are still running Windows, that are still managed using Windows tool, but are this much smaller, minimal footprint OS? So when you're thinking about 2020, if you're thinking 5 years out from now, this is one of the first things you're thinking about. 5 years out from now, do I want most of my core infrastructure roles running on NanoServer? Or do I want them still running on, say, Windows Server 2008? This approach of Microsoft adding roles and features when they are ready will apply not only to NanoServer, it will apply to Windows Server 2016. So rather than having to wait for the next version to come out, just expect it to come out when it's ready. There will be programs where you can get on the program. There will be literally something like the Insiders program. I don't know what it is, but there will be. That you'll be able to test. It won't be like, yeah, we're throwing it out and deployed in production now, but it'll be, hey, if you want to be on the Insider ring, here's this version of Windows Server that you can go and test in your environment, and then maybe a couple of months after that, the final version of that code will be ready when it's been tested. There's a very different approach to this sort of monolithic approach where we get, at the moment, there's a Technical Preview 3 that's out there and people can go and play around with it, and we know that there might be a TP4 or a TP5 and a beta, and then we'll get a release. No, instead expect once we get the release of Windows Server out there, there will be options then to get onto a fast track where you will get new features and new roles as they become available, or modifications to existing roles. And a good example, for example, with DHCP would be in Server 2012 R2, you got DHCP failover. Who's played with that? Right, it's a really cool feature. All you do is you pair your DHCP servers, and if this one stops responding, this other one comes up and automatically starts leasing addresses from the same scope. And it's not the 80-20 rule. They keep an eye on one another, and when the other one comes back up, then they go back and load balance. So you can have load balanced DHCP that's built into the server. Expect features like that. One day it'll do it, and then you'll just get your release notes, and it goes, oh, okay, now I can do this with my DHCP server. So there will be a continuous introduction of new roles, features, and functionality, rather than having it occur all at once every few years. There will be a long-term servicing branch. So for those of you who are, there's that wonderful picture of Grandpa Simpson, where he's saying, I used to be with it, and now I'm not, and I find everything new, scary, and weird, and you don't find that weird now, but you will in future. And there will be some of you who go, look, absolutely not. Am I going to have these features roll down? I want to deploy Windows Server 2016 as it comes out of the box, and I want to keep it in production as long as I can, and I don't want to worry about functionality changes, because of course that brings up questions about training, it brings up questions about stuff being broken. But remember that the mantra that the new Microsoft has is far more along the lines of the mantra that Facebook has. Move fast, and if stuff breaks, well, try and fix it as quickly as possible, rather than the very conservative Microsoft that we are far more used to, which is we will release something after we've tested. It will be tested, but if you're uncomfortable with that, you've also got the option of long-term servicing branches. And it might be that you take a mix and match approach. Some servers are one, other servers you're happy to have sort of more out at the forefront. So with long-term servicing, if you're not fully aware of the way it works in Windows 10, you still get software updates, but you don't get new features and functionality. And with the Enterprise Edition, you can actually decline a software update for up to 10 years with Windows 10. So if you don't want to install it, you don't have to install it. You're not going to have software updates shoved down your throat if you're running the Enterprise Edition. If you're running the Consumer Edition, there's a different story. And there's a different story for a lot of reasons, but I'm not here to argue about that. But did I mention I'm speculating? I'm not telling you anything that I've been told in confidence. This is just a rational extrapolation of Microsoft's messaging on Windows 10. Now, many organizations have developed the habit of decade or more server deployments, and this is where we're talking about rolling core infrastructure upgrades. When Server 2003, as I said, reached end of life, there was between 8 and 10 million servers running the product. We see that about a third of the people in this room have Server 2003. There are still millions of computers running this operating system, functioning as the backbone of infrastructure in government and business. Now, many organizations have opted for expensive support agreements just so that they can keep running Server 2003. Who here has one of these custom support agreements with Microsoft? So there's a lot of you who are just running it going, well, we'll get there. So that's very interesting. The US Navy just signed a massive multi-billion dollar contract to keep running Windows XP. Windows XP, which came out before my son was born. My son is 5'11". He's a 12-year-old. He's really tall. But when I sit there and I think, wow, this came out before you were born, and you're in high school now, what are people thinking still running that OS? But they are. So a lot of organizations and a lot of systems administrators have it, the approach of deploy it and keep it in production until we need an archaeologist to go and find drivers for it. Now, it wasn't always this way. Who here had got their start in IT before Windows 2000 came out? Now, don't feel bad about that. No, I'm serious. This is something I've been discussing with people. The average age of an IT pro is 42. Very Douglas Adams. Of the most of them have been in the industry since the 90s. IT pros are not like developers. Developers are like Logan's Run. You get to age 30 and they kill you. IT pros, we're smarter than that. We don't have the little pulsing flower in our hands, so we don't get taken by the Sandman. But there is a... most of you were there when Windows 2000 was released. And I remember when Windows 2000 was released because I was I had a support call from a branch office, and they had Windows NT 3.51. And I'm sitting there in 2000 going, how on earth does anybody have a seven-year-old operating system still in production? The difference in average server hardware between 1993 and 1999 was substantial. We were really feeling Moore's Law back then. Most organizations didn't or couldn't, simply because of reliability issues, keep old servers around for months or years at a time. If you had a server that was old, you knew that thing was going to crash, right? You think about how reliable you thought in 2000 of a server that was released in 1995 was. Now, you think about the same distance in time now. You got a server that you deployed in 2010, you're not worried about it failing. It's only 5 years old. So there's been a big shift in the way that we think about these things. Replacing core infrastructure roles in the past wasn't unusual, simply because the servers were a bit more like mayflies. Windows 2000 had replaced NT4 in most large organizations by 2001, 2002. If you saw an NT4 server in 2005, you were really surprised. I mean, I know I still meet some people who go, yeah, we've got the NT4 at a branch site, and it's like, where is your branch site? You know, do you use a DeLorean to get there? Think about the transition from NT4 to 2000 and Server 2003. It was something that for most of us actually happened pretty quickly, and then something happened. We didn't go off 2003, or when we could, we did it very slowly. It took us a lot of time, and there's a lot of reasons for that. There's literally the five-year break between Server 2003 and Server 2008. There was also the Server 2008 R2 coming out as only 64-bit, and there's a lot of people who went, well, you know, we've got Server 2003. It's running an x86 processor. We're going to keep it. Now, today, server hardware is getting more and more powerful, but we've reached a point where, except for a few specific applications, that power is not used. In fact, that's one of the reasons why virtualization took off. We got so much power that we just started putting more and more workloads on the same machine, simply because we weren't throttling that machine. It wasn't like we got to the point where our domain controller was overusing its hardware. We just started virtualizing our domain controllers and saying, that's okay. We can put another thing on here as well. Unless your organization has grown substantially, it's unlikely that the domain controllers that you had 5 years ago are suffering bottlenecks. Now, why did organizations get off the migration treadmill? Why did organizations hold on to Server 2003 so long? And there's a lot of reasons for this. They're institutional. There was simply that it wasn't considered a priority, because we went from how we conceived about these roles changing from being, oh gosh, we've got to keep moving, to, you know, it does what we need it to. And that it does what we needed to, that distance, I think, changed the psychology of IT, and people started getting away from this idea of treadmill upgrades. Up until a certain point, we completely accepted that we needed to upgrade our servers every couple of years. Then we kind of got to the stage where we're like, you know, we can survive with Server 2003. It's not a priority to get us off this operating system. And this is what a lot of people face from management when they say, hey, we've got to go and migrate from Server 2003 to a new version of the operating system. And management's response is, if it's still working, why do we need to move? Why do we need to change? Oh, because it's not supported anymore. What does that mean? Oh, it means Microsoft's not giving us patches anymore. Yeah, is that going to mean it's going to stop working? Well, no. Okay, we'll leave it there until it breaks. And that's practical. I mean, there's changed economic conditions. We're not sitting there going, hey, you know, we've got budget to go and change something that's kind of working at the moment, especially Kiwis, who are far more pragmatic than Australians. You're probably sitting there going, well, those bloody Australians would do it, but, you know, I like throwing money into fire pits, you know. So it is. It's about pragmatism, and we've become a lot more pragmatic, and also with our age change, we've become a little more conservative about how we do things. Whereas when we were 25, we might have sat there and gone, yeah, got to be latest and greatest. At 40, this works. This is solid, this is reliable, this is good. We've gone from I need a sports car to Volvo's, an option. New features simply don't entice organisations to upgrade if they're not using the existing features to capacity. And servers, unfortunately, are like barnacles. They're a lot harder to move the longer they've been in place. Now, server 2012 R2 end of life in October 2023. So 8 years from now. Many administrators and organisations expect to keep their server workloads running until the hardware expires. And now that we're virtualising everything and the hypervisors support these old operating systems, suddenly we're not facing this, oh, the hardware's going to die anymore. You can keep running it because it's running in a VM, and VMware's not going to turn around and say, well, we're not going to support you running your operating system. They're going to be like, oh, well, it already does it, so we'll just keep that feature in as long as you need it. Hyper-V will do the same thing. And suddenly you're finding that these servers that would have naturally have given up the ghost, it's sort of like, imagine if you could virtualize your car and then you never had to worry about replacing the parts on it because it was sitting in this environment where everything sort of seemed to last forever. At what point then do you make yourself get off the operating system? Because there's suddenly, even that pressure is gone. With a highly redundant virtualized fabric, hardware simply no longer fails. Practically from the point of, obviously, you know, you have these things fail, but you move your VMs across there. The roles that are running on those VMs, they're not going to fail. How long do you think your server 2012 R2 server should be in place? So who here is pretty sure that they're going to be running server 2012 R2 when end of support expires in October 2023? No, that's fine. That's realistic. This is what I'm talking about with planning. If you're planning it, you're thinking, oh gosh, I hope not. But unless you're thinking about it now, you're going to put it to the back of your mind. I wrote a column for Windows IT Pro on Server 2003 end of life. And I started 18 months before 2003 end of life. And my first column was start thinking about this now. And I still had people writing to me a month before it happened, and they go, oh, we've just started thinking about this now. And we thought about it and we went too hard. So HP, who sponsored the column, came back to me a month after end of support expired and said, we'd like you to keep doing the column. I said, why? It's end of support's expired. How do I get them off? And they said, no, there's so many people that are still running this operating system that we feel that you've got an audience. So I think the same thing's going to happen with Server 2012 R2. The only way it doesn't happen is if you have a plan. And hopefully management, as stubborn as it is, within 8 years can be worn down to hopefully upgrade to a new version. Now, why is it important not to leave servers in place? There's a really good reason. The first step to securing your network is to make sure that your infrastructure servers are secure. And the easiest way to do that is making sure that you are running the most recent version of your OS, especially on infrastructure, because infrastructure ties everything together. The most recent version of the OS is clearly the most secure. There are many, of course, service-specific mitigations that you can put in place and best practices that you can put in place to lock down a server that's already in production. You can go and look up, how do I lock down a DHCP server? How do I lock down a domain controller? And you can go back to 2003 and you've got all of those special practices. but the most secure version of that is going to be the most recent. At the moment, it's Server 2012 R2. In a year from now, it'll be Server 2016. Now, why is this? Well, as we know, while older versions of the OS still get updates, newer versions are more secure simply because Microsoft has learned how they stuffed up in the previous version, or the holes and all of the lessons learned there, and they put that knowledge into the new version. It's not sort of like they go, well, we didn't learn anything from all of the security patches we had to apply to Server 2012 R2, so we're not going to include those in Server 2016. Of course, they're sitting there going, we learnt this, we learnt this, we learnt this, we learnt this, and all of that knowledge. And this is why there's such a big security difference and why it's almost, it's functionally impossible to lock down Server 2003. There was a patch released 6 months before 2003 end of life where Microsoft said, we're releasing this patch for 2008, we're releasing it for 2008 and later, but we're not releasing it for Server 2003. And the problem is that if we release this for 2003, there's going to be so many applications that stop working that organizations pretty much aren't going to be able to adopt it anyway, because there's so many applications written under the assumption that those security holes existed, and they were more sort of side products of that. And Microsoft was, you know, it will be so hard for organizations that have got Server 2003 already to adopt this patch, they're better off just upgrading. So Server 2003, it's like XP. If you're running XP, there are so many exploits that you can run against XP. It's not a difficult operating system to compromise. Attackers are also becoming a lot more sophisticated, because while we are aging, our attackers are getting younger. Well, they're staying the same age, they just seem like they're getting younger. The tools that they are using are getting much more comprehensive, and they're far more readily available. Kids at my son's school know how to VPN around, because they've all got iPads, they know how to VPN around all of the content filters at the school. This is year sevens, and get to porn. Now, think about that 20 years ago, where you had 12-year-olds that knew how to, and it wasn't that they're brilliant, it's just that those tools exist. You can go to the App Store, you can download a VPN client, and then you can just run the VPN client, and you can, it'll encrypt your transmissions, and suddenly the school can't tell where you've gone. We're getting a generation that knows that there's tools out there. There was an amazing survey done last year that found in the Fortune 500 companies, 40% of them had Tor traffic running on the internal network. So what was going on was people were bringing in the Tor browser on a USB stick and running Tor to get around all of the organization's firewalls. And they were just blasting through the firewall, and then they were using the organizational network often to download Game of Thrones and things like that. So it's not that the kids are becoming smarter, it's simply that by their nature they're becoming more sophisticated. When most of us got into IT, the people we were dealing with were numpties when it came to technology. They had no idea how the computers worked, and we knew that we didn't have this threat facing us from the people we worked with, simply because we knew that their level of technical literacy wasn't high enough that they posed a realistic threat. Anybody who was a realistic threat was probably already working with you in the IT department. Now, according to the Ponemon Institute, 33% of attacks that occurred last year were launched by insiders. Millennials are far more aware of how to carry out an attack on IT infrastructure than Gen X or Boomers were. It's not that they're great, it's just that they know that they all have to do is Google, how do I go and attack this? Pluralsight, which is a wonderful company that I work for, and you can go downstairs and you can go, one of the companies I work for, you can go downstairs and get a little voucher, has so many courses on how to hack stuff that it's incredible. I mean, it's all under the rubric of certified ethical hacking, and this is how you go and penetrate your, test your network. But if you sit down and watch the courses, you learn how to use Metasploit, you learn how to go and use tools to find exploits, that you can go and run, and they go, well, yes, you're meant to be authorised to do this, and they mean it when they say it, but all of those courses exist. And of course, Pluralsight stuff gets ripped off and posted on YouTube. If you've ever watched YouTube hacking videos, they're usually like 11-year-olds that are on way too much Red Bull and maybe have taken helium going, I'm gonna get him. But this is the environment we find ourselves in. Remember that figure, 33%, a third of your attacks are gonna come from inside the firewall. Malicious insiders don't need to have good IT skills. They just need to know where they need to download something. And these days, if they know how to use Tor, you know, you could ask them, go and find that. And they'd be able to find the tools because they're digital natives. So part of the reason that Microsoft is really switching the way it releases OSs is simply to keep up in the security arms race. If it was releasing an OS every couple of years, and Microsoft is absolutely horrified at the number of people that are on server 2003. Not just from a, hey, we'd really like more money for you to go somewhere else perspective, but simply how do you get people, how do you get organizations to start thinking about this so that they're not running an operating system that was, and 2003 was really made in 2001, an operating system that's 14 years old. So while you could keep Server 2012 R2 around for the next 8 years, doing so is going to expose you to increasing risk. Now, by definition, infrastructure is at the core of your network. It is what makes other things go, or it's, you know, it's like Brondo, it makes plants grow. But no one got that joke. Terrible joke. Never should do that again. By keeping it up to date, you can minimize the chance that anybody can successfully attack your network. So keeping your server OS infrastructure as close to the cutting edge gives you not only the widest variety of roles and features, it gives you the strongest baseline security. Now, staying within spitting distance of the cutting edge requires a shift in approach to how we think about servers hosting infrastructure roles, because most of us think of them like they're statues, that we put them in and they're gonna stay there forever, because that DHCP server's gotta stay there, because it's a whole pain in the backside to move. That DNS server's gotta stay there, that domain controller's gotta stay there. We sit there and we think of these as fixed points, you know, as they'd say in Doctor Who, this is a fixed point, it can't be changed. Well, no, we need to change that mentality, and that's what the whole idea of rolling core infrastructure upgrades is. These infrastructure roles, let's just bring it back to the basics. DCs, DHCP, DNS, Hyper-V, WSUS, certification authorities, and file servers. Rather than deploy for a decade, what we need to do is we need to change our attitude. We need to think of these things as temporary deployments. Temporary being, yes, several years, but not, I'm gonna put it in, and then I'm only gonna be taking it out 13 or 14 years for you, or someone else will be taking it out 13 or 14 years ago, because you'll still be in the industry probably, but someone else might be in your job and you might have moved on, hopefully to something that's much more awesome and gets you a Ferrari. Don't allow your workloads to put down roots. Who here feels that they've got infrastructure workloads that have put down roots? Okay, a couple of you, and that's fine. Who here feels that their server 2003 servers have put down roots? Yeah, and exactly, and it's just not something that there's a trepidation. The longer it's been there, the harder you find it to even get the emotional energy to want to move it. So think of the workload as something that can be moved from server OS to server OS as you need to. Don't sit there and think of it as tied to the server OS. If you design and deploy with the idea that the workload is portable and that you will be migrating it in the next few years, it will be simpler to migrate, simply because you will go, oh, I'm doing this, and you will think, okay, now if I had to move this, what would I do? Migration, of course, gets easier with practice. And one of the things, one of the big sessions here a couple of years ago was on migrating from server 2003 to server 2008. And that was a big jump. But if you are migrating between recent versions of the OS, it's far easier to do a step-up migration from one version to the next than it is to go for a big jump from, say, Server 2003 to Server 2012 R2, because you were literally jumping three or four versions of the OS. Microsoft also provides a wealth of tools that allow you to migrate from one platform to another. And these tools always work best with the previous version. One of the things now that Server 2003 is no longer supported by Microsoft means that funds are not allocated by the company to maintain those tools with backwards compatibility. Anybody who's used the User State Migration Toolkit will know that, for example, operating systems like Windows 2000 and Windows XP are no longer supported by the toolkit. The moment that Windows 10 came out, you couldn't do a migration from Windows XP to Windows 10, because Windows 10 came out after Windows XP had end of life. So those tools that could have made that migration possible don't exist. And remember that that's going to happen. So your best version, the sharpest version of those tools, is when you're using them with the most recent versions of the operating system. So consider the server and the infrastructure roles as separate in the stack. That yes, you've got a DHCP server, and yes, the DHCP server may live at this IP address, but the host operating system is something that you can change. Or, even better, the DHCP server can live at any IP address. You just need to have two DHCP servers on your network. And that's a better way to think about it. Don't think the DHCP server's got to have this name, and it's got to have this IP address. Because the moment you're doing that, you're making your migration more complicated. Remember that Active Directory's got all of that dynamic stuff in it for a reason. And it is that this stuff can be moved around. Yes, I would assign a static IP address to a DC. That's usually a good idea. But no, if I was replacing that DC, does it have to have the same IP address? The only reason something has to maintain the same IP address is if someone's done a dirty little hack where they've gone and mapped a drive, or they've gone and specified a resource by IP address, and we know that that's bad. I'm doing a session on Friday called Bad Server Administrator Habits, and that's one of them. The other, and you've been warned, if you've got a service account that's a member of the domain admins group, you're a bad person. You're a completely understood person, but you know, it's one of those. It's going to be one of those sort of Alcoholics Anonymous sort of things where we go through all those things that we do and we talk about that. So that's on Friday morning. Infrastructure should no longer be. Work out which bits are fixed points and then stop them being fixed points. Make them so that they're migratable. Migrating an infrastructure workload needs to be something that you never procrastinate about again. It shouldn't be you that's stopping you. It should, unfortunately, be management that's stopping you. But at a certain point in time, what we're going to see with this sort of rolling, ongoing version of Windows Server is that hopefully you'll get stuff to this, and then suddenly you'll got over the hump, and then you will be able to deal with everything a lot more. Having an up-to-date set of migration skills, of course, is important. And there's a lot of people that made a lot of money migrating people off Server 2003. And it's hard to get the process of migrating to a new version of Windows if you simply don't know where to start. Now, migration is much better than an in-place upgrade. An in-place upgrade is where you put the CD in, not that you do that anymore, you put the DVD in, or you go and get the installation media, and then you upgrade in place. If you look at most of Microsoft's migration advice now, they say don't do that. They say don't go and upgrade the thing in place. Go and build another server and then move stuff across to it. It also gives you a fallback position. Simply, if the migration goes bad, you've still got the original server in place, and then you can have another go at it. It's a lot harder to roll back an operating system upgrade than it is if you've just got a separate server. And these days, a separate server is just another virtual machine. Server administrators are like evil geniuses, and they should always have an escape plan. It also means that you start to understand that the only thing that really should carry over from service role to server role is the data associated with that role, be it the settings or the internal database that's associated with it. So while these in-place upgrades work, they're hard to roll back from, so avoid them if you can. So you've got transitive migrations and you've got cutover migrations. What a transitive migration type, I'll talk about in a second, but you can usually perform either one. You select which one you're going to perform depending on your objectives. Transitive migrations, where you move a workload from one server to another. For example, ADDS DFS and Hyper-V. I'll give you examples of how that works. You join a new server to the domain as a member. You use existing tools, and Microsoft has tools that are downloadable from their website for all of these migration scenarios. Use existing tools or built-in processes to replicate the workload to the new server. I'll talk about specifics in a moment. When workloads have been migrated, you simply decommission the original server. A cutover migration is where you switch from the current host to a new host on the same server, and that's where maybe you do have that stuck IP address, and then you basically shut down a server, you put a new server in place that's got exactly the same characteristics as the old server, but you actually have to have a place where that service is disrupted, and you usually do that, you know, at some god-awful time in the morning. Use a migration tool or a backup tool to backup the current workload, data, and settings. Build a new server that you can import the existing data onto, and that's how you do the migration. Now, there's greater downtime involved, but it is functionally a similar process to the one that you would take if you had had a complete server die on you and you had to go and replace it. So it should be something you're kind of familiar with from your backup drills anyway, because we've all had, and it happens a lot less often now, we've all had a domain controller that's just died or a DNS server that's just died and that we've had to go and replace from backup. So we know how to do this. And to a certain way, that sort of cutover migration is like a recovery from that sort of disaster. Things to watch out for, hard-coded IP addresses. This is the one that usually people freak out about because they know that they exist out there, that someone's done a network mapping, someone's gone and pointed at a resource, and it's hard-coded. This is especially with things like SQL Server. If you've got SQL Server and you've got applications that use that SQL Server, someone's put in the IP address because for some reason DNS wasn't working the day that they set it up, and they've gone, that's the way I'm going to do it. Active Directory computer accounts. Now, in some cases, people go and use the same name and then there's a problem because of the Active Directory computer account. Or they go and delete an Active Directory computer account that's a member of a whole lot of groups that no one's documented. And then they've gone and created a new Active Directory computer account and gone, wait a sec, why isn't this working? It's because it hasn't been assigned all of the privileges that it might have needed for that particular workload. Now, the good thing about basic infrastructure roles is they're not like applications, where applications very specifically do have a lot of compatibility issues that you might need to work through. Microsoft is usually pretty much, we know that people are always going to have DNS servers, so we've made the path for migrating a DNS server fairly straightforward. Specific examples, domain controllers, in with the new, out with the old. It's very simple. What you do is you add a server running a new version of the OS to the domain. So let's say you've got a server 2012 R2 domain, you want to put in a 2016 domain controller. First thing you do is you add 2016 as a member server. You then promote the 2016 server to be a domain controller. And when you do that, a whole lot of stuff goes on within Active Directory. But if you have promoted a domain controller recently, you will know that all of that domain prep and forest prep all happens automatically, and you don't have to do it as a manual step. It's designed now that this is how you go and introduce it. It's not a big foo-foo. It all happens automatically, and it's all been fixed so that almost all of the blocking issues, because Microsoft found that the biggest blocking issues to actually deploying a new domain controller were problems with forest prep and domain prep and preparing FSMA roles. You add additional servers running the new S and then promote them as well. So you've got one domain controller running 2016 and then you've got five domain controllers running 2016. You move your FSMA roles across, you enroll your custom partitions, you take care of all of that other stuff, and then when you've done that, you demote your old DCs and then remove them from the domain. Once you've demoted your old DCs, you simply upgrade your functional level because all of your new DCs are hopefully running the new version of the OS. Hyper-V migration. In clusters or standalone, it's very straightforward. You can use, if you're in a cluster, you join a node to the cluster, you move stuff across, you add multiple nodes, and then you retire your old nodes. Or you set up replication, you replicate the VMs across to the new nodes, and then you retire your old nodes. With DNS, if it's Active Directory integrated, that's already taken care of if you're doing a domain controller migrating. If you've got a standalone DNS, well, there's tools that allow you to go and you create a secondary server running the new OS, so you'd have a secondary DNS server running 2016, and then you can just switch it over to become a primary server, and then you just make sure that you've got all of your settings, which you can back up using DNS CMD, or you can actually just do it from the console. You can back up any of special settings in terms of replication and so on. So Active Directory integrated DNS migration, very straightforward because it's already within Active Directory. DHCP server migration, again, fairly straightforward. You open a command prompt, you go netsha DHCP server, you specify the IP address, and then you simply export the DHCP settings from the original DHCP server. And then you copy that file to a new computer, and then you authorize the DHCP server and import that settings, and that'll bring all of those reservations across. It won't bring the leases across, so of course at some point clients will have to renew their leases, but that's not a problem. Now, all of this information is of course available on the slides, and of course the presentations are recorded, so you don't need to write any of this down. You can just simply go and get the slides and pick up all of these bits and pieces of code and advice. Certificate services, okay, so this is why I just mentioned that. There's a whole lot of mucking around you need to do with certificate services, but certificate services is also one of those roles that people freak out about migrating, because they sit there and go, well, there's the root certificate, and really, not only do you have the root certificate, you've got the certificate revocation list distribution points. And why that is scary is that every certificate points to a CRL distribution point, and it needs to be able to contact that distribution point, otherwise the certificate becomes invalid. So you've got to be always careful. You back up the databases, you back up the policy, you back up the role, you put it on a new server. This is one of those scenarios where often you do keep the same names, simply because that means that you keep your CRL distribution points in the same place, and then all of your certificates remain valid. Subordinate CA migration is pretty much the same. CRL distribution point migration. Always try and keep the same names, because you need to keep the same CRL distribution point names for the lifetime of any certificate that you have issued in your environment. If you're fine with basically reissuing all of your certificates, don't worry about it. If you've only got a couple of certificates out there, it's not going to be a problem, except for a lot of people find they migrate their CA and then suddenly their existing certificates that they didn't know about suddenly don't work. And the reason that they don't work is that they're all looking for the old CRL distribution point. File servers and DFS, lots of tools to do it. And remember, it's not just about migrating the files and their permissions, it's also about migrating the shared folder permissions. There's a lot of people who just go and copy the shared folder from one computer to another, and then they forget entirely about the shared folder permissions, and then wonder why Barry from accounting has got access to the CEO's personal spreadsheets. DFS migrations, simply add a new server to each DFS namespace, add new servers to host new copies of the DFS replicas, and then when that's all set up, you simply retire the existing replicas and the existing namespace servers. Migrating WSUS, you need WSUS 3.2 or later, and there's a trick where you actually go and get SQL Server Management Studio from the free edition of SQL Server, and what you can do is back up the Windows internal database and then import it onto a new WSUS server. And when you do that, all of the approvals that you've done in the past and all of the computer groups come across. Because with WSUS, yeah, you can download all of the updates again, but what you don't want to do is have to go back and figure out what you'd approved in the past, assuming that you actually spend a lot of time thinking about what you approve and just don't approve everything as it comes in. Desired state configuration. So one person asked me last time I gave this talk, could we use desired state configuration for this? Sort of. The thing to remember with desired state configuration is desired state configuration builds you the initial configuration of the server. It does not bring you the data. So while there is DSC information about, for example, how to populate DHCP scopes, unless you want to program every reservation into a desired state configuration file, then you don't want to do it that way. It's great at your initial server configuration, but it doesn't generate all the data. And remember that I said that the real issue with your server infrastructure is making sure that data goes from the old servers to the new servers. Now, you can use automation in conjunction with DSC, but it is a lot easier to just figure out those policies and those procedures to migrate. Do things manually where necessary. That's an unusual thing to say at Tech Ignite these days, because we're all about automation. And tomorrow I'm giving a session on basic PowerShell commands that allow you to do basic normal things rather than writing, you know, foot-long scripts, just because it's a better way to get people into PowerShell is by getting them to do simple things like restarting computers, renaming computers, creating user accounts with a single line of PowerShell rather than these long scripts, because most IT pros, when they see a script, go, ah. And there was apparently one of Alan's user group members who said, I'm back where I need to be. And someone responded on Twitter, where is that? And he said, I'm back with systems administrators who don't need to know how to code. So that's not very doctrinaire in terms of Microsoft, but there's a lot of systems administrators whose ideas about coding are, gosh, we wish we really don't have to do this, because we kind of got into systems administrators so we didn't have to be programmers. Don't spend a couple of days automating a process that will only you'll only do a couple of times and only takes a couple of hours. Now, are containers the future of infrastructure? Those of you who may have heard Windows Server 2016 supports containers, are we going to be deploying DHCP containers or DNS containers? No. Containers do not contain persistent data, which means that they're really poor for these infrastructure roles that are all about persistent data. So while you might spin up a Minecraft server in a container, each time you did that, you'd have to configure it with a random seed, but you'd stop the container and you'd spin up a new container and all the stuff your kid had built in the Minecraft server will have disappeared. Never say never, but generally application data lives outside the container. There's an exception to this with SQL. You will be able to spin up a SQL server instance in a container, but the database will have to be stored outside the container. So that way, you'll be able to just spin up new versions of SQL in containers and point it to the same databases and it'll go and mount those and use those. But the data stays outside the container. Now, in terms of server images and templates, just make sure you keep them up to date. On Ben Armstrong's blog, there's a beautiful script that will automatically each day go out and check whether or not there's updates that apply to your virtual machines, and it will go and apply those updates to your virtual machine. So there is something like the virtual machine servicing tool that you can run in the background. That means that each time you do deploy a new server, it is up to date with updates. Nano server deployment is a work in process, but do plan to be migrating your infrastructure services to Nano in the future, simply because if you migrate them to Nano, then you are going to have to worry about rebooting them a whole lot less. Anyway, I've pretty much covered everything I want to cover. I've got through pretty much the entire session. I am happy to answer questions. Anybody got any? The session and the slides, the video will be available in the next few days. The slides will be available on the website. Yep. Any other questions? Yep. That's a good question, one that I don't have an answer to at the moment. If anybody else has got any questions, please come up to the front. Otherwise, thank you very much, and please fill out your evaluations.